This is an ABC podcast.
In the Pacific Islands collection of the Queensland Museum, there is a carved wooden club. This club belonged to a man named Womalee, a South Sea Islander who was working in Queensland in the 1870s. And this wooden club is one of Imelda Miller's favourite items in the whole museum. Imelda is the Queensland Museum's curator of Indigenous cultures. And one of the reasons that she loves that club is that Womalee brought it from his homeland of Abram, a volcanic island in Vanuatu. And Abram is also the homeland of Imelda's great-grandparents. As an Australian South Sea Islander, there are many chapters to the story of Imelda's heritage. But some of those are lost because of the circumstances that brought South Sea Islanders to Australia back in the 19th century. As a curator, Imelda collects these stories, helping to reconnect people and places. Hi, Imelda.
Hi, Sarah.
Tell me about this club. What does it look like?
Sarah, it's a pretty plain club. You know, a club is a club. but it's, you know, it has some stature about it. You know, it's made of this really heavy brown wood and it's slender, and then at the head there is a very distinct shaped club head, which is very distinct to the Abram style as well.
And what would it have been used for?
It would have been used for fighting. It was used for in ceremony. It could have been used for many different reasons. But the description in the museum catalogue doesn't say that.
Well, what does it say?
It just says this is a club from Abram.
As curator, do you get to hold it? Are you allowed to pick it up?
I have picked it up. And I love that kind of contact that you do get to have with objects. And for me, when people come in contact with objects, I feel that's when objects come alive and their stories are awakened and, you know, and different stories from different people, and the object starts to show itself to you.
Well, when you pick that up, when you're holding that wooden club in your hands, what's going through your mind? What are you thinking? What are you imagining?
I can remember one of the first times I saw the club, because it came from down on the Logan area, which is where, I mean, not only did my great-grandparents come from Abram, but they also came through the Logan area. And so I wondered if Womalee was there at the same time as my ancestors. Did they come on the same boat? Did they come for the same reasons? But then I also thought, who was Womalee? What did he do? What made him come out here? And did he come by choice? Or was he forced to come over? Like, so many questions.
There are thousands of items in the Pacific Islands collections at the Queensland Museum. And I think the record states that Womalee's club was donated by his employer in the 19th century. But what about all those other things? Where did they come from? How did they end up in the museum?
Yeah, good question. the museum we acquire items in many different ways. Today it's through acquisitions and donations. But I suppose it's, you know, in the past, in particular, a collection that I work closely with, which is the Australian South Sea Islander Custom Collection. In that case, items were collected by, you know, captains of labour ship vessels, government agents, farmers who own sugar plantation farms, even mayors of those towns. But in general, throughout the collection, there are a lot of government officials who are donating things. There's medical doctors, you know, people who are travelling the landscape, who have contact with people, different people in the landscape, and maybe people who are not fully understanding what they're finding and when they're finding it and thinking that maybe no one's using it.
And when we say South Sea Islands, where are we talking about? What exactly are the South Sea Islands? Because they're not south of where we are here in Australia.
They're certainly not south of here. So for me, and in particular to the Australian South Sea Islander story, the South Sea Islanders are the islands from Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, New Caledonia, Fiji, Kiribati, and Milbay Province of Papua New Guinea as well. So they're the islands that in this context I call the South Sea Islands. But that has been interchangeable also with Pacific Islander, Polynesian Islander over a series of 150 years.
And what was it that led to people from that range of islands being brought to Australia in the 19th century? What was going on?
So in the late 1800s, people are starting to look at cotton and they're starting to look at sugar as plantations to, I suppose, farm here. But they didn't have much labour. And the conditions here were harsh, it was hot, you know, it's starting to warm up today and we're still winter. And so you can only imagine what it would have been like then. So Australia is starting to look for a new labour force to help develop the start of their Australian sugar industry. But they need the labour to clear the land. And there's not many people here at that time other than Aboriginal people who Europeans are now starting to take over the landscape belonging to them. And they're looking for people to work in this harsh climate, these harsh conditions. They've heard of, you know, where America was using African people, and now they're thinking, oh, well, maybe we can access this source of labour from the Pacific Islands. So in 1863, they first started coming here. That's when the first boat arrived into this bay here, you know, into the Brisbane River, into the Logan area. But eventually, they started coming into places like Maribor, Bundaberg, Rockhampton, Mackay, Townsville, and Cairns, so all along this coastline, and it spread down into northern New South Wales as well.
Were people from those islands agreeing to come voluntarily? Were people kidnapped? How was the process of bringing people to come and work on sugar farms and other kind of farms on the Queensland coast happening?
Well, a term that's commonly used is blackbirded, and that is the use of coercion, of people being forced, the use of trickery to convince people to come out here to Australia to work in the sugar industry. However, some did come by choice as well. I question what do people understand about that exchange when it's happening, but over the years I've heard many stories of people talking about their ancestors either, you know, swimming out to a boat to see what it is, being tricked onto boats, and I've heard about families in the islands who still wait for loved ones to return home or their families to return home.
And what kind of stories of being tricked have you been told?
I've heard of people, mainly people being tricked and coerced onto boats to look at something, and then you hear that people being coerced to go down into the hulls. And just, you know, you hear families talking when they talk with families back on the islands about people just disappearing, and they wait for, you know, in the past they waited for the day for them to return and they never returned.
Was it only men, young men, who were taken like this?
There were men, there were children, there were women. And, you know, they were on these ships, and they came out to, you know, it's not like jumping on a plane like we do today. And they're coming out here to this place they don't know. And they are then exposed to conditions, harsh conditions. And they're exposed to diets that they've never, you know, foods they've never eaten before, diseases they've never come into contact before. And so they're faced with a lot of challenges.
And what kind of work were people set to doing once they arrived on the Australian mainland?
Well, they were here clearing the land, Sarah. You know, the land was full of scrub, and it's not like how we see it today. And they're working hard to clear out the shrubs and the scrub and the bushes and the trees and clear that land to make way for, you know, these plantations to be planted.
And what kind of places did people live in? Are there records of, like, what housing was or what accommodation was like?
If you go to the State Library, you can see pictures of people living in grass houses. There were times when people lived in barracks accommodation. You've got to remember, though, there are people from all different islands coming here, and they all speak different languages, they all have different customs, they all have different protocols, and yet they're brought into Australia, and they've got to try and figure out how to live together, how to work together, how to communicate, and expected to get along. Because people were busy, they were working. They were working from sun up to sundown. And then when they had a day off, they were going to church.
Yeah. Were people paid wages, Imelda?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a term called indentured labour, but you'll hear many people talk about their ancestors' working conditions that were akin to slavery. And, you know, we're talking about people being... Islanders being paid £6 a year to that of European white labour who were being paid £30 a year, you know, and there's talk of people not really ever seeing that money, you know. They've got to pay, you know, some people had to pay for clothing and things like that.
So you say, as you say, that term blackbirding is used. Is slavery a more accurate term, do you think?
Slavery is definitely a term that is used today. I mean, if you look at the conditions, they were slavery-like conditions. The only differing part is that some people were paid, because you do hear stories of people saying their ancestors weren't paid. And therefore, you know, I think it's nicer to think we didn't have those kind of conditions here. And that we do are a part of a good country, but you know there are parts of our history I think that we all need to come to terms with.
Were South Sea Islander people free to return home to their ancestral countries? You know, whether that arrived here through being tricked or voluntarily, could they go home when they wanted?
So people were, many people were placed on what we call an indentured contract. So they were contracted for 3 months, and after that it was the farmer's responsibility to return those people back to their home islands. Some people are known to go backwards and forwards, while others stayed here and continued on to other contracts.
When the White Australia policy was introduced in 1901, how did that change things for South Sea Islanders living in Australia?
So in the 1900s, Sarah, there was 10,000 islanders recorded living here in Australia at the time. And they are doing well. You know, some people have been here for now 40 years. People are having families. They're starting to create community here. And the White Australia policy brought about legislation that ordered the deportation of islanders back to their home countries. Now, I think that was by 1908. And the South Sea Islanders, some of them were thought, they didn't think this was fair because some people were very much embedded into this landscape with families. They had married into other, you know, people from other islands. They had married people from Aboriginal communities here and also married into European families. And so people fought and they created what was known as the Pacific Islander Association, who got together petitions to actually fight for South Sea Islanders to actually remain here in Australia.
It's interesting or telling, isn't it, that that what ended this process of often indentured labour wasn't because the white legislators realised that this was unfair or bad practice, but because they'd introduced another even more racist kind of legislation, which was we don't want anyone who's not European living and working in Australia. So it's a strange way to be granted a freedom or not a freedom coming out of the White Australia policy. And then, as you say, telling people whether they want to or not, they have to leave. How many South Sea Islanders were able to stay in Australia after that White Australia policy was introduced?
Well, there's some probably 1,500 South Sea Islanders who remained here. Although, you know, that number is debatable as well because people hid from being deported, so that number was probably higher than that. And it is those who remain, that small amount who remain, it's their descendants today who are now called Australian South Sea Islanders.
And what did those people who stayed do for work, Imelda? Did they stay in the sugar industry or did they have to find other kinds of employment?
Well, Sarah, there's lots of legislation brought in to stop South Sea Islanders from working in the sugar industry.
Oh, really? So the very industry that they built up.
The very industry they built up where there was now, like, yeah, now not wanting them to be a part of it. So
what did people do?
They would try, you know, they moved onto the outskirts of towns and they found other ways of living, creating island gardens, fishing, probably doing activities that they knew that they used to do on the islands, I suppose. And I think it's really interesting because then I think there's these communities then that just start to settle and probably evidence of still in the landscape today where people are still living. And I think that they were banded together, you know, to survive in this landscape.
When you were a kid, what would your mum show you to help you understand where it was that your family had come from?
Yes, I was very curious as a child and I was always very aware I was a little bit different to everybody else. And I do recall sitting in the kitchen one day around the table and asking my mum, you know, where are we from? And she pulled out this tea towel and it had the New Hebrides written on it. And she goes, this is where we're from. And I was like, and I remember thinking, I'm from a tea towel, and I, you know, because my concept of the world at that time was like, you know, very here and now, you know. So, I didn't quite understand that, but I started to get the concept I was from somewhere else.
How much was the history and the stories of South Sea Islanders talked about in your family?
Oh, it was always talked about, you know, and you know, we always heard our ancestors were from the South Sea Islanders. Even that word ancestor as a child, like trying to comprehend, what does that mean?
And what is meant by ancestor? You know, that is different than saying your grandparents or your great-grandparents. It's a much bigger term, ancestor.
It is a bigger term, you know, and it means many, you know, and it gives you this idea that there is depth to your history and that lineage is long. And I think that, you know, you get an idea that, oh, I come from a place and I have a resilience of people who go back a very long time, you know. And when you say ancestor, when I say ancestor, that's what I'm talking about.
Whereabouts did you grow up? Where was the kitchen where your mum was showing you this tea towel with the New Hebrides drawn on it?
And it was we lived in a little gold mining town in central Queensland called Mount Morgan.
And was there a big community of South Sea Islanders there?
No. It was us and, you know, my cousins who lived in another town not far away. But Rockhampton wasn't far away and there was a huge South Sea Islander community in Rockhampton.
And Mount Morgan is famous, as you say, as a mining town. I think at one point it was the world's biggest gold mining town.
Biggest open cut mine in the Southern Hemisphere.
So you would have been taught that at primary school.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
Was the mine still operational when you were growing up?
It was, actually, and the town was huge, you know. I mean, I was only a child, but I do remember there was like a pub on every corner, you know.
What about the sounds of the mine? Is that something that you can remember from a kid's sounds connected with that mine?
Yes, I do remember sirens and I do remember explosions happening as well. And I remember, you know, there's a siren around 3 o'clock and I don't know, I just assumed that was end of shift. My friends who did have families working in the mines might have other things to say about that, but that's the memories I recall. But it was very vibrant and, you know, I made good friends there. I still keep in contact with many friends who I grew up with. You know, I love people from there. It doesn't sort of matter how long they haven't seen you for. Everyone still, it's like you just saw them yesterday and it's always lovely to reconnect.
How did things change in Mount Morgan after the mine stopped working?
Yeah, well, my memories of when the mine stopped working were, you know, my friends left town, and many of them, and it was sort of this mass exodus of people who then had to, you know, their parents had to find other work in other places. And because, you know, it's not just about the mine, is it? It's about all the industry that surrounds the mines. And as that slowly dies down, there's other industries then that get the effect of that, I suppose. And so, yeah, my friends had to move away, and the town, the school sizes, you know, your classrooms got smaller. But, you know, I think the town is resilient, yeah.
You also spent a lot of time at your grandmother's place. Whereabouts did she live?
Yes, it was my mother's mum, and she lived in a little place called Joskalee, which is about 40 minutes east of Rockhampton.
And what kind of place was Joskalee when you were there visiting as a kid?
Oh, it was, when you go there, it was like a little dirt road. And you'd go onto the dirt road and you'd travel along. There'd be all these cabbage palm trees along the sides of the road. And there were swamps. You would cross over swamps and you'd go over a salt pan and all these smells, you know, and all the trees, when you see them and you see the salt pan, it just reminded you of home, you know, just told you you were home. And, you know, we go down the dirt road and past the old church and go to my grandmother's. And she lived in a house that was built by my grandfather. And, we would spend, my brother and I would spend every weekend there just about while we were growing up.
And was that a place where a community of South Sea Islanders had moved to after that work in the sugar industry came to an end?
Yeah, it's one of the, it's a little settlement that was made, you know, I suppose people settled there. Like my grandmother's sister used to be there and some of her children lived there. So it was, you know, it was a community and there was lots of kids to play with, cousins.
It's right by the ocean. Was there good fishing?
There was great fishing. And I suppose the thing about Joskalee is, I mean, it's really special to us. It's probably not the ideal location because it's actually really situated between two swamps. And it's probably the land that, you know, no one would really care to live there, but to us it's really beautiful. And it is close to the beach and we used to eat, you know, go fishing and eat fish, all the foods of the sea often. And I do remember, you know, my mum serving us fish for dinner and my brother and I thought, can we just have sausages and steak like everybody else? Not knowing until I was an adult how much seafood actually cost and what a blessed and privileged life I actually lived.
Because there's a little island just off the coast there, Gird Island.
Oh, yes.
Would you go out there?
Yes, I went a couple of times as a child, but my cousins went a lot. I was a bit younger than everybody else, I just heard my aunt recalling a story about going over there and getting oysters off the rock and, you know, this terrible childhood that we all had.
And you're just wanting sausages
and
meat.
Yeah, I just wanted sausages.
What about music? Because music is such a beautiful part of Pacific Island cultures. What was music something that you remember from Joskalee?
Yeah, I suppose for me, music, I connect to church and people singing and people playing guitars and piano accordions and singing hymns. But also, you know, people playing guitars and singing other kinds of music as well, definitely. And on my father's side, a lot of my cousins are very talented and they sing and play musical instruments to this very day.
Was church a big part of your grandma's life and of your life when you were visiting?
Yes, church was a very big part of my grandmother's life. And I think many South Sea Islander communities, South Sea Islander people, religion has played a part in our lives in some way. Whether it still does today or not, it depends on the person. But definitely has played a part in our lives. And, you know, every Sunday the routine would be my Nana, my grandmother would wake up and she would put the Sunday roast on. And the old, you know, this is when the it was like a fire, the old stove with a fire. And she would prepare all of that and get the roast ready and make the dessert, and that would all be put on then while she went to church. My brother and I would, of course, go to Sunday school before she went to church, so we were up early and our cousins would come along and collect us and we'd all go to church. And I would never be able to read the Bible because I was too young to read. So I remember my cousins always having to flick through and find the hymns. And, you know, I was like that person that everybody always had to help.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Imelda, when you were growing up in Mount Morgan, did you imagine that one day you'd work in a museum?
I had no idea about museums. I had no idea that I would be in this world. And I always say to people that it chose me and I didn't choose it.
Well, how did it happen?
I actually started out in museums just to make a dollar to pay the rent and to get by. And the curiosity got me from there. I used to do school tours and then I slowly learnt about the collection. And I realised that you're able to volunteer in the collections. And so I joined a group where we used to volunteer and, you know, I started to come into contact with objects and started to think about the stories that they tell. And it just blew my mind that all these objects would be sitting in a museum, yet no one got to see them. And I just so wanted to share this experience with other people that it sort of became a life passion and I was hooked.
What was the first exhibition you worked on that got to showcase some of this South Sea Islander history and identity?
Back then, senior curator, his name was Michael Cornell, and he was before his time. He was the senior curator of Oceanic Anthropology at the time, and he really embraced and encouraged whenever he found an islander to connect to the collection, even encouraged it more if he found someone that was interested in working with it. And it was through him that he got me into exhibitions, and one of the first ones was actually an exhibition we called Discovering Queensland, and he encouraged me to actually do a story on Joskalee. And I just talked about my interactions with my grandmother and, you know, had a photo of me and a couple of photos of my cousins and some food that grew around the area and the little church we all went to Sunday school at, you know, and talking about South Sea Islander history.
What kind of reactions did you see from people who came and saw that? I guess particularly people, other Australian South Sea Islanders. How did they respond to seeing this story in a museum?
It's really interesting, Sarah, you should ask that question, because people would always say to me, oh, I saw your story at the museum, or, oh, it's good to see your face, you know, I saw your face there, I took a photo of it, you know. And I really felt like people started to connect because they saw not just me, but they saw themselves. And I think that really sort of resonated with me a lot, how important it was for people to kind of see themselves or see something that connects to them.
And when you say that, you know, the museum has all these objects that are hidden away, when you started doing exhibitions that were bringing them out of the back shelves and the storage containers and putting them on display, how do people from the community respond to seeing some of these items? What have you witnessed?
Oh, people are overwhelmed. You know, it's almost like a silence falls over the room. Any community that I have either worked with or come to visit me or come to visit the collection, there's almost a silence that occurs, and I almost feel like, oh, I've done something wrong, or there's something here that shouldn't be here. But I think people are just in awe, and I think everyone is reflecting. You know, we talked about ancestors before, and I think people reflect on their ancestry and what has happened to make them be here on this day to have that experience and to be able to connect with these objects, these photographs, and what does that mean to them? Like, to be visible, to see that these things are still here. And they are still here.
And I suppose these items aren't just history. There's something living about the objects that someone sees from their own story, their own culture.
Very much so. And for me, that is the power of what I try to do in the work that I do, is to connect these objects in the collection to the people who they mean the most to. There's something that happens, Sarah, and these objects come alive and stories come alive, and, you know, people start recalling memories and they recall people and they recall place and that connection, and there's almost a sense of belonging. And, you know, and some stories are happy and some are traumatic, and you can go through all kinds of emotion, you know, when people come to visit, because you don't know what people are bringing into the room. And you know, I was just thinking before I came here about what is my job as a curator, and I think, you know, I'm a carer of collections, but I feel like I'm a carer of community and carer of stories and creating safe spaces for people to come and just be and have the experience that they're meant to have in that space.
Have there been times where people from Vanuatu or the Solomons are here in Australia and see these objects? And what kind of response do they have? And how might that be different than an Australian South Sea Islander?
I've just recently actually been talking with some community from the Solomon Islands. And it's really interesting to see people connect with the objects, and I feel like you get other stories, and they're those stories from home and country, and it's the other side of the story. Like, I feel like when I particularly look at the custom collection, they're talking about the ancestor before Australia, and they really connect to that. And I definitely see that, especially as well when I'm looking at the historical photograph collection, perhaps in the State Library, where then people look at the photographs. As we look at photographs and we see our families and we can tell who is from which family, they can tell what islands they come from, what village they come from, and in the historical photographs, because the people in the photographs, their features are strong. But by the time you get to the third generation, like myself, the features have faded away, they're all a bit mixed. So, you know, you get to have those kind of experience. But definitely I do feel like when you have people from Vanuatu or the Solomons here, that connection is deep. And it just reminds me about how deep our heritage goes, but also there is a little bit of sadness because I think about the things that we've lost along the way.
You worked on an exhibition called Plantation Voices at the State Library, and a choir from Vanuatu came out to perform at that. What was that like?
That was magical. it was the gift that keeps on giving, is what we like to call it. And then when the choir came out from Vanuatu, they were on their way to Northern Territory for a big festival, and they stopped in to look at the exhibition, and I remember giving them a tour of the exhibition, and I stood in front of this photo of the South Sea Islander women in the cane fields in North Queensland. And as I'm talking to them, I'm going to probably get emotional now, but as I'm talking to them, I realise that this is their ancestors as well. It gets me every time. But, you know, and we all got emotional all at the same time that day, because we all realised that we all belong to that story. And then, you know, because I'm here and they're here and these are all our ancestors. Yeah.
Did they sing, Imelda?
They did. They did do a performance at the library. They performed a couple of hymns, but I think the most special moment was there was one elder in the crowd that was able to come that day, and they brought her over and they sang to her because that connection is strong. And I thought that was really powerful because that particular elder probably would not be able to travel back to the homelands. So it was a way of connecting her to place.
In the work that you do, researching and going through the collections, looking at photos, have you found items that directly relate to your ancestry, to your story?
I suppose I have found stories. In a way, they all relate to me. I just connect with it in different ways at different times and depending on what I'm doing. And I think as a curator in a big institution like the Queensland Museum, it's hard sometimes because you're the researcher and you're the research. And so you work in this area that's complex because you're not only dealing with, you're doing your job, but then you have the community, you know, you have the cultural responsibilities, and you also have the emotional, you know, you're dealing with it on an emotional level. So it's professional and it's personal and it all comes together and it's quite complex. And sometimes you're dealing with it in a very public space as well. So you've got to learn to kind of control that because especially if you've got other visitors, it's not always, it's not about myself and my experiences. It's about giving people their space and their time. It's also time for me to connect to the collection as well. And I suppose when I do exhibitions like Plantation Voices is a moment to kind of acknowledge these photos of people as people and that they had families. And that's something that I try to do in my work is actually this is not just about a historical event that happened 150 years ago. That event is intrinsically a part of our identity and we're still alive and living today.
How much detail do you have about your where your mum and dad and their families were from?
I have a little bit of detail, but some parts are not. You know, there's some pieces that we just don't know because the names change, they're spelt differently, you take on new names. Miller is certainly not a name from the islands and it's really hard to trace back if the names have been changed. So, but I have been lucky enough that some of that has been recorded in little community booklets. They'll have stories about different families and so I've been lucky to have that recorded in there and some information that's been passed on, you know, generation to generation as well.
How common is it for Australian South Sea Islanders to visit their ancestral homelands, to make the journey back to Vanuatu or the Solomons or Fiji or wherever?
Well, in COVID, we're not doing anything. But I suppose, you know, since about the 70s, I think people have started going back to reconnect with families and to look for people from what they knew and try and make that connection. And some families have been really successful. Certainly my grandmother, when she was still alive, she went back to Ambrum, to a village called Wakon Village. So her maiden name was Wakon. And so Wakon was, you know, it was Wakon, and of course spelt here Wakon. And she was able to go back, before she passed away, she was able to go back to the village from where her father came from.
Wow. What did she tell you about that? What was that like?
I just remember her being really excited. And I did have a conversation with my aunt the other night because she was with her on that visit. And they didn't know they were going to go and do that. My grandmother had been to, this was her second visit. And they had made up their mind that they'd made some contacts and they decided they'd charter a plane and go to Ambrum. And they went to Ambrum. They didn't know they were going to go to the village. And they jumped on this boat and they went to the village. And my aunt said that she was greeted by the village with all these gifts. And it was like that's all she wanted to do before she passed away was to go to the village that her father was from. So she was able to do that. I think about, you know, I get emotional every time, but I think about, you know, she was in her 70s, 80s to have that experience to go back, and I wanted to wait that long and that her father didn't get to go back and what that must have meant for him.
And for the families that were there waiting for
correct
their members and descendants, it must have been such a beautiful, welcoming experience for the people in the village as well.
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, to have someone return, yeah.
So what about you? Have you been to Vanuatu? Have you been to Ambrun?
I haven't been to Ambrun, but I have went to Vanuatu once, and I was lucky enough to go with my parents. And that was life-changing experience for me.
Tell me about it.
It's funny because, you know, it was such a beautiful place and I remember just thinking, it looks just like the postcards. Now, I had the same thought about when I saw Saturn through a telescope for the first time. I thought, it's just like the posters. But it was so beautiful. And I just remember walking along the water's edge and my father was there, my uncle was there, and I don't know, this thing came over me where I just sung out, oh, I got it. And my uncle was like, what you get? What you get? And I said, I get it. This is where I'm from. They were all laughing. They're like, yeah, this is where you're from, you know, this is where your people. I said, no, like, people always say I'm happy, but I get it. Like, my people are happy. It's not just that I'm a happy person. Because everyone always used to call me Smiley or Smiler, but it's because my people were happy people, you know, and I just had this moment of, I could feel my ancestors shoot me in the heart, like at that moment, and it was just the most grounding moment for me to be able to reconnect in and to be able to do that, like, with my parents and my uncle and my aunt. And I thought about them having their first time there as well, and I just thought, that's just so, like, I'm having this, you know, in my mid-20s, but you're having this in your 50s, 60s, you know. And
what was it like for your dad? What kind of connections could he make?
Yes, so I had an experience with my dad when we went to Vanuatu. I had gone to the market that day to have a look at all the fresh fruit and vegetables and to bring something back for us to eat. And I remember walking back into our accommodation where we were staying, and I saw my dad sitting down, and it was like he was talking to everybody. And, you know, he was sort of talking English but not talking English, but it was, the conversation was flowing, you know. And I remember, like, observing and thinking, oh, hang on a minute. You know, in my head I was going, what's going on here? Like, how can he understand what they're saying? Like, how can he have this conversation? And I don't usually interrupt my father because you don't do that. But I did say, you know, walk into the conversation and go, hang on a minute, I need to ask a question. Like, I need to understand what's happening here. And I said, Dad, how come you can understand everyone and I can't? And he said to me, oh, wow, the old people used to talk to me in language, but we always had to be talk back in English. He goes, so I can understand what everybody is saying, but I can only speak back in bits and pieces. And I said, but why didn't you teach us? And he goes, well, I never knew that we were going to come back here. And he said, you know, and the old people always said, this is our new home here in Australia, and we didn't need to know all these other things, and that we had to work our way best to just be like everyone else here. And we didn't need all these other things because we wouldn't be able to return home. So, yeah. And my dad had always told me about, you know, the old people talking in language and him having to speak only in English. But to see that in action, I think, really kind of brought home to me some of the things that, you know, we miss. And it may be part of that trauma of us as a community as well.
As a curator and as someone working with the museum, is there still history to make sense of? Are there still items to collect, say, from the parts of Queensland and northern New South Wales where South Sea Islanders were brought to work on those sugar plantations and farms? Are there still things that you think we want to go out and talk to people and add to our collection?
I think there are big pieces that are missing. I mean, this is a very big part of our history, as I've said, and it is important. But I think that we as a community have done so much over the last 150 years that that also needs to be recorded. And so at the moment I am working with a couple of communities in the north to talk about what are these experiences, what have we been doing as a community, who are our important people and what are the important places, and how can we tell that through objects and helping the community understand what is an object, you know, because I think people don't, you know, some people don't understand it, or they think of it as something as really old. But like a t-shirt, a hat, a pair of shoes, a rodeo ribbon, you know, a cast net, these are all things that tell stories about who we are, who we have been, the experiences that we have had. Because I don't become a curator at a state museum without having other giants to stand upon, you know. People have done a lot of work to enable pathways for many of us to have the successes that we have today. And I want to make sure that they're recorded for future generations so they know that who our heroes are and where that resilience and where that strength comes from within our community.
When were Australian South Sea Islanders officially recognised as a cultural group, Imelda? I mean, that history and that identity has always been there from you. When did the rest of Australia catch up?
Yeah, so in the 70s, Sarah, they started fighting for recognition, and it's the likes of people like Nasmin Anais, Faith Bandler, you know, they were all fighting for us to be recognised. And finally, in 1994, the Commonwealth Government recognised Australian South Sea Islanders as a distinct cultural group.
And was that significant? Was that a meaningful day for the community?
Yes, it was a meaningful day and still is a meaningful day, because without that recognition, we were existing as no one, you could say. And without it, you can't help the community. Like, you need to be somebody. And by having recognition, we became a community, united. And it enabled us then to talk about who we were and then start to create awareness about what our history was, how we got here, and now start to address, you know, some of the issues and challenges that we faced, but also trying to find solutions to some of those things, especially around health, education, employment, training, to help our community to be successful.
There was a word for Australian South Sea Islanders that's now considered derogatory. How do you see that word now?
Yeah, so the word Kanaka was a very derogatory word in the past, and I still see it as a derogatory term.
It was a term that white Australians used about South Sea Islander people.
Correct, yes. And I can only imagine how some people heard that used when in reference to themselves. And so I think we have been very respectful of our, you know, our old people to make sure that we don't use that word. Today, however, young people and members of the community are starting to reclaim that word as their own, in their own terms, with their own conditions, and power to everybody for doing that. I know young people seem to find it, they find a lot of strength in that word, and they've reclaimed it in their own way, whether it be in songs, whether it be in artwork.
There's a footy comp. Isn't
there's
there?
A footy competition, yes, which will happen in Rockhampton in November.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I suppose the footy competition, it came out of a place of reconnecting our young people in with our history. So it's not just the footy competition. It is a competition between two main towns, which is the two main communities, Rockhampton and Mackay. And they come together in different towns, in each town. But it is about reconnecting young people with their history. So when they go back to each of these towns, they're taken and they meet with our old people or our elders, and there are talks. They presented jerseys by their elders so that they know who they are. Because some people live in different towns and then they meet an old uncle who lives in another town, you know, so they start to make that connection and that they don't become strangers, you know, to family. So, and it's a good opportunity for the community to come together in a bit of friendly rivalry.
Who are you going to be barracking for in the Kanaka Cup?
Look, I'm neutral. I just kind of support everybody coming together and being friendly. But I get lots of enjoyment out of, you know, unfortunately I don't get to go home and see every football carnival, but I just love seeing the photographs that come out of it of everyone being happy, that younger generation making connections with other families, and this is forever with them as they go, you know, as they grow up.
Melda, it's been really a great joy to speak with you on Conversations. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me, Sarah. It's been an absolute privilege and to be able to share my story and talk about Australian South Sea Islander history and heritage.
Imelda Miller is the Queensland Museum's Curator of Indigenous Cultures, and a lot of the objects in that collection, including Womalee's Club, can be seen online at the Queensland Museum website. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hi, it's Richard here with a podcast recommendation. If you're keen to get some lively family discussions happening over the dinner table or on long car trips, then this could be the podcast for you and your kids. Short and Curly is an ethics show about life's tricky ethical questions, and hosts Molly and Carl have a new season.
Ho, 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 so much to do. I've got to fuel the pixie dust tank on the sleigh, polish Rudolph's nose, and stop the elves from unionising.
Santa?
Carl, you've got to hide.
Santa!
Carl, what are you doing? No!
Santa, it's me, Carl Smith. Remember me? I send you a letter every year.
Carl, what are you doing here? And how did you get past the polar bears?
Ah, yes, the polar bears. Short and Curly, the kids' podcast for the whole family. Download it from the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.